Well, hello everyone. This is Wayne Matson with the Wayne Matson Report, coming to you this November 21st, 2009, live from Washington. This is not a replay. I've been recovering from swine flu. I hope my voice holds out because I'm still sort of stuck with the after effects of H1N1, and that's not what we'll talk about tonight. We'll save that for the future. I've been in Mr. Gaddafi's tent last month in Libya, and I'll talk about that. We'll save that for a future program. But tonight, this program, because tomorrow is November 22nd, it was November 22nd, of course, 1963, that President Kennedy was gunned down on the streets of Dallas, Texas. And I am going to be talking about not what you usually hear about with the Kennedy assassination, concentrating tonight on the officer who was shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, J.D. Tippit. We have never heard the full story about Mr. Tippit, and I have uncovered some audio courtesy of Philadelphia broadcast pioneers, audio from WCAU, AM, and FM, the Jack McKinney Show. This was broadcast back in the 1965, and it had to do with J.D. Tippit, amongst other things. The Warren Commission had come out with its report, and two of the individuals on Jack McKinney's program thought the Warren Commission was a cover-up. I'll play those clips, and we'll listen to a few other clips showing that Mr. Tippit, who was just honored this past week in Dallas because they found not the police car he was driving when he stopped Oswald in Oak Cliff, the Oak Cliff section of Dallas, but a movie prop Dallas police car. It gets so strange. Used in the 1977 TV movie, The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald. The car was restored. It's now a memorial to Mr. Tippit. But Mr. Tippit, listen, this guy, we've never heard the real story about J.D. Tippit, but in tonight's show I hope to expose some of the things we were never told about this Dallas policeman and his links to both Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. And you'll be amazed to hear what some people said as early as 1965 about Mr. Tippit. He was not what he appeared to be. Of course, a lot of people in Dallas were not what they apparently claimed to be. That went from the mayor to the police chief all the way down. So we'll talk about that. You'll hear some clips, including this very rare and really obscure clip from this WCAU radio. WCAU doesn't exist any longer. It was a well-known talk radio station in Philadelphia in the 1960s and 1970s, but fortunately somebody saved this very important audio archive, and I'll play a few clips from it this evening. You'll be amazed at some of the same arguments you heard against the 9/11 Commission were used against the Warren Commission, and the same kinds of individuals who threw around a conspiracy charge were around in 1965 with the Warren Report, and they're around today. These people, their career, they're paid, obviously, by people to be people to throw cold water on various theories, but and certainly 1965 and the Warren Commission saw its fair share of these same individuals. And we will come back with our program tonight, J.D. Tippit, Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald, right after this short break. This is Wayne Matson coming to live from Washington, D.C.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Oh. Okay, welcome back. This is Wayne Mattson with the Wayne Mattson Report, the Saturday Roundup, coming to you live tonight, this November 22nd, the eve of the anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. And before we get to this clip, I want to read from Thursday's Dallas Morning News. On Friday, the gleaming exact replica of J.D. Tippit's car will be escorted to the spot on Patton Avenue in Oak Cliff, where the officer confronted Oswald and was killed 46 years ago. The story of this unusual memorial begins in an unusual place, at a junkyard in Arlington, Texas. About 5 years ago, Dallas police were notified that one of their old patrol cars, possibly Tippett's, was rusting away in the salvage yard. Well, it wasn't Tippett's car. Amazingly, city records revealed that his car was put back in routine service the very day of his death. It was eventually wrecked and scrapped. Can you imagine? The car, driven by the guy who shoots Oswald, is put back into service and then eventually wrecked and scrapped. I mean, it was not checked for fingerprints or anything. They put it back into service on November 22nd, 1963. This is amazing. And back to the article. In those first few years after President Kennedy's assassination, Dallas was trying to erase history, not preserve it. Gee, I wonder why they were trying to erase it. No, the car in the Arlington salvage yard was actually an old movie prop. The vehicle used as Tippett's in the 1977 television movie, The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald. It was, however, a real 1963 Galaxy 500, just like Tippett drove, and those cars are increasingly rare. So the idea of a replica memorial began to take shape, and right now it has become a memorial to Dick J.D. Tippett. Let's go to this clip that will recount part of what happened, especially what was going on with the Dallas Police Department on November 22nd, 1963. If we can play this first clip.
The car wanted in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy has been stopped in Fort Worth. Police report that the suspect in the is in custody. Further word will come later. Fort Worth is 30 miles west of Dallas. Just a few minutes before this report, we heard from one of our newsmen in Dallas on the scene, James Kerr, who said that a Dallas policeman, J.D. Tippett, was shot to death by an unknown man in a car minutes after the president and Governor Connally were shot. The officer was shot about 2 miles from the scene of the presidential assassination. Repeating the first of this bulletin, the car wanted in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy has been stopped in Fort Worth. At an intersection, police reported that they had the suspect in the shooting on the ground. We hope further confirmation will come on this momentarily. This is Charles Murphy reporting from WBAP-TV, Fort Worth, Dallas.
In Fort Worth, 28 miles west of Dallas, police picked up one suspect who was later cleared and released. The man apprehended was identified by Fort Worth police as 22-year-old Donald House of Ranger, Texas. House was picked up after Dallas police put out a pickup order on his car following the shooting and killing of a Dallas police officer. As he was taken into police headquarters, House shouted, "I didn't do it." And after questioning, he was completely cleared and released.
Oh, God, we got to indoctrinate this guy.
Well, several hundred officers swarmed through every entrance in the theater and found this man sitting in the second row from the back. He was armed with a shotgun. The officers jumped him, wrestled the gun away from him, and then pulled him out through the doors with him screaming, "I protest this police brutality." He was really fighting them all the way, kicking and screaming and hollering until he got to the front entrance of the theater. There was a crowd, I'd say, of 2,000 or 3,000 people had been attracted to the theater by the all of the screaming sirens and people descending on the area.
This man was captured in the theater. Have you heard reports that he was the same one? Now, Vic Robertson has been giving us information on that. And he said that there was a terrific search being made and a chase on Jefferson by police in attempts to apprehend a man that they believe is the one they found.
Identified me was in the Texas Theater. We went to this location, surrounded it from the outside, and then about eight officers, including one FBI agent and some uniform officers, went into the location. Officer Ennio McDonald was interrogating his third person when, as he approached him, the suspect jumped up, struck him in the face, and yelled, "This is it," and made a grab for a pistol, which was inside his shirt, down in his belt. The officer and the suspect both began to grapple for the pistol. The pistol trigger was pulled one time, but the gun misfired. By then, at the officer's call, the rest of us got into the situation and subdued the suspect, disarmed him, handcuffed him, put him in the car to the station, and turned him over to Captain Fritz and the Homicide Bureau.
Let's break here. There you heard two conflicting reports. One that Oswald, when first confronted in the theater, had a long arm, and the other was that he had a pistol. Now, you know, how do you get that wrong? And how does one walk into a theater with a long arm? You also heard that, you know, they were turning Oswald over to Captain Fritz of the Dallas Police Department. Now, Captain Fritz is the guy who destroyed all the interview notes with Oswald. Can you imagine? Here's your suspect who just supposedly shot the President of the United States, and your notes are torn up and thrown into a waste paper basket. I mean, it just defies logic. But anyway, let's go to our second clip. We may have to break for a commercial, but let's go to the second clip because I want you to hear part of this interview on WCAU from 1965.
The fact is that the shooting of Tippit occurred very close by to Ruby's house, a point, incidentally, which the Warren Commission in no place mentions. It makes a point
how
of saying...
By? How close?
A matter of $3. A matter of $3.
Okay. That is the intro to the program that was on WCAU. Now, we'll play more of this after the break, but let me tell you as a way of a setup for this segment. The guy you heard talking there was a man named Sylvan Fox, who authored a book called The Unanswered Questions About President Kennedy's Assassination, one of the first books to question the legitimacy and the veracity of the Warren Commission report. He was joined on this program by an individual named Curtis Crawford, who was an instructor at New York University, who was also the author of a book called 20 Questions for the Warren Commission. Another individual, Charles Kramer, was a trial lawyer, member of the International Academy of Trial Lawyers. This individual, of course, is poking holes in the theories of both Crawford and Fox, saying he's standing by the Warren Commission report. Well, isn't it funny? This is from Philadelphia. We all know who came out of Philadelphia, who was the general counsel to the Warren Commission, who came up with the crazy magic bullet theory, and obviously it was one of Kramer's good trial lawyer buddies, one Arlen Specter. So you have to put all this in its proper context. Obviously, Kramer, just like all the people today who throw cold water on the other theories about 9/11, Kramer was the guy they picked, one of the guys they picked to throw cold water on the books written by Sylvan Fox and Curtis Crawford. No different than some of the abuse heaped on people like David Ray Griffith and others who have written about 9/11. You see, because when the government appoints any commission, whether it's the Tower Commission that looked into Iran-Contra, the Rockefeller Commission that looked into CIA, NSA, and FBI abuses, pre- and post-Watergate and during Watergate, or the Warren Commission report, or the 9/11 Commission, every one of these commissions have the same mandate: cover up for the government's crimes, cover up for the people who committed these crimes, government, non-government, it doesn't matter, and they always find these individuals to serve on these commissions who will basically do the bidding of these individuals. I just want to make mention that this airing of this program was after November 9th, 1965, because that's when Arlen Specter was elected Philadelphia's district attorney. And Arlen Specter served on the Warren Commission, as I said, as its general counsel. And he's referred, of course, into this program as the district attorney-elect. So it's quite clear that Specter had one of his buddies on this program to basically attack the authors of the first two books that came out that questioned the veracity of the Warren Commission report. And, you know, we can go into all kinds of details, but tonight I want to remain focused on J.D. Tippit because this individual has always gotten what I consider to be a pass on his potential role, his relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination. I can tell you that it's well known in Texas among people who worked in the intelligence community that there was a dinner the night before that would have been November 21st in Dallas at the Egyptian restaurant. President of that dinner meeting were some of the biggest mafiosi people in Dallas. The Egyptian restaurant was owned by a mafia figure. At the meeting was Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. Okay, this is the evening before the assassination. So we will come back with more from this program about J.D. Tippit and Oswald and Ruby right after this short break. This is Wayne Matson from Washington.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. This is Wayne Matson with the Wayne Matson Report. This Saturday Roundup coming to you live tonight. This is November 21st, 2009. We're talking about November 21st and 22nd, 1963. Without further ado, let's go to this clip with this show from Jack McKinney from WCAU, November 1965. We will join them as they're talking about the real story behind J.D. Tippit, who was shot by Lee Harvey Oswald. Let's go to this clip.
A police car drove up in front of the house at the very moment that Oswald was there.
Right. We didn't introduce this before, and I think it's valid that you bring it up now.
I mentioned this briefly before. I thought you had, and I wanted to make sure it was clear in our listeners' minds what was involved here. Now, Mrs. Roberts' testimony is that at about 1 o'clock, thereabouts, Oswald was inside changing clothes, and that at that time, a police car drove up with two men in it, and a number of which she remembered as something like 106 or 107. It had the number apparently, as it stayed in her mind, had a couple of big circles in it. Now, Mrs. Roberts maintained this. She said that there was a context for her, that policemen, there was a car that fairly frequently came up to the house involving friends or acquaintances of hers. She looked to be sure. She thought maybe it was these acquaintances. It turned out not to be the case. She did not recognize either the number or the car or the people in the car. The horn was honked a couple of times, and then after a few instants, the car drove away. Now, something that this is mentioned in Mr. Fox's book, but something he does not mention is the number which was on Tippit's car. You remember what that number was?
10.
10. There is a circle in 10. There is also a long mark in 10. I'm not saying that this is proof by any manner of means. I'm not saying this is proof that it's Tippit's car. But it seems to me that an alert commission should have faced the possibility that this was Tippit's car.
All right. I'd like to remind our listeners, this is 121 on your AM dial, WCAU and WCAU-FM in Philadelphia. Sylvan?
Yes, I'd like to add to that. I didn't mention the Tippit car because I myself was very uncertain about whether this was substantial enough connection, that is the 10 and the 107 or the 106. However, the another omission in the report is very significant in this context here, because The commission tells us this whole story in detail, or at least it's in the testimony. I'm not sure whether it is in the report now that I think about it, but it is in the testimony anyway. And the commission describes, the testimony describes the whole business, but the commission at no point ever resolves this point, that an investigation was undertaken to determine what this car was. And remember, this car was there during a three-minute period when Oswald was in the house. He was not there longer than 3 minutes, and yet this car was there at that time. The commission investigated this, that is, the FBI investigated for the commission, and they found that car 106 was at the book depository, as was car 107, as was car 207. But 170 and 107 had been sold in April of 1963. Now, what they do not tell us is, to whom were these cars sold? What became of these cars? Seems to me, as I pointed out in the book, that in any kind of conspiratorial arrangement that was going on, if indeed one was, this would be a very ideal situation, that to use an accepted police car of the Dallas Police Force and carrying a number which had not been reassigned to any other car so there could be no conflict, and to have this car moving about the city.
A further point that could have been explored was that the practice of the Dallas Police Department in disposing of their old vehicles, was it the practice of the Dallas Police Department to do what most municipalities do, and that is remove insignia before the sale?
Even the removal of insignia before the sale would prove nothing, because that insignia could easily be restored.
So, right. Are you suggesting that this testimony might be indicative of an allegiance or an alliance between Tippett and Oswald?
No,
and
I'm not.
The direction
I'm not,
of it. I didn't get the point.
I'm not making
any supposition.
Supposition.
But what is it? What is the direction you're suggesting?
I'm the one who brought it up. Why don't I respond to
you? Are you then suggesting it as a conceivable or possible theory of some alliance between Tippett and Oswald?
If I had been a member of the commission, I would have felt that there was sufficient question as to the encounter between Oswald and Tippett to investigate the hypothesis that they'd known each other before.
Now,
and this is why I tied that in. Oh, by the way, I tend to question that Mrs. Roberts ever saw this.
Well, of course.
I'm not saying that because a witness says something, therefore I know it to be true. Quite on the contrary. But I brought it up because my point was that I think the commission should have investigated the hypothesis that where Oswald was going was to meet Tippett.
Well, Curtis, you do know, of course, that the commission did investigate whether or not Tippett and Oswald ever knew each other, and they state that based on our exhaustive investigation, we find no evidence of the fact that they ever knew each other. Now.
Okay, well, there you have it, folks. That that was from WCAU 1965. Questioning, what relationship was there between Lee Harvey Oswald and J.D. Tippett? Understand that Tippett was alone, there was no one else in the vehicle, and a few other things, and we'll talk about more about J.D. Tippett and Oswald right after this break. This is Wade Madsen from Washington.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Okay, welcome back. This is Wayne Madsen with the Wayne Madsen Report, this Saturday Roundup, and tonight we're talking about the assassination of President Kennedy, which was 46 years ago tomorrow. But not just what you've always heard. We're focusing on the relationship between Lee Harvey Oswald and J.D. Tippett, the Dallas policeman who Oswald allegedly shot. And what kind of relationship did they have with one another, and possibly both of them with Jack Ruby, who later shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas Police Department. Let's go to this last clip. This is a real gem from WCAU, November 1965, hosted by Jack McKinney, who passed away back in 2002. But he had this great show where he had had these guests on, two authors who were the first to come out and question the veracity of the Warren Commission report, and, of course, some shill, obviously a friend of Arlen Specter from Philadelphia, who was defending the report and all of its cockamamie theories contained therein. Let's go back, and you're going to hear something extremely interesting about where the boarding house was, and that's where this Mrs. Roberts took ran the boarding house where Oswald stayed. There was a police car that pulled up before the encounter between Oswald and Tippett, and you're going to hear something very interesting about where Jack Ruby lived in relationship to the Oswald boarding house. Let's go back to the clip from WCAU.
Well, there is about, at around 12:45, give or take a few minutes, there are instructions to Tippett and a fellow patrol and another cruiser to move into the Oak Cliff area and to be alert for any emergency. A few minutes later, the dispatcher checks to find out whether Tippett is there, and Tippett reports that he is there.
Yes, there's one more little element, and that is that, as I recall, there's an attempt to raise Tippett on the radio at 1 o'clock, and it's unsuccessful.
That's correct. That's correct.
And that's very interesting, too, in the context of what Curtis said, because, remember, at 1 o'clock, this police car was outside of Oswald's house.
But also, a significant point that we can't overlook is the fact that Tippett was ordered to be in the Oak Cliff section.
No doubt about it. Which in itself is rather strange, by the way, because most of the cars had been ordered either to the book depository or had been told to remain on their own station.
You know, there's a funny story about this, which I just can't keep from telling about. The commission had available for the first 4 or 5 months of the investigation a transcript of the radio log provided by dispatcher Hensley, who was one of the dispatchers on the radio that day. This transcript is printed in full in the documents of the commission, and upon investigating that transcript, I discovered that it was very much edited, very much curbed, shortened, abridged. I was able to discover that because it turned out that there are two other copies of the Dallas radio log transcripts which are much fuller versions. But the interesting story is why the commission went after the second. Well, in the first transcript, there were no orders to Tippett to move into Oak Cliff. And so what one of the funny parts is, there then began a long series of depositions asking Dallas police officers why in the heck Tippett had gone to Oak Cliff, because this was not the area he was supposed to patrol. And you should see all the ingenuous attempts to explain this. Well, as a matter of fact, it's the shortest way to the Texas School Book Depository, which it really isn't. Well, as a matter of fact, Tippett would realize that the Oak Cliff cops had gone to the building, so he would have moved into Oak Cliff to cover. Well, all sorts of rationalizations that proved beside the point when they turned up the second full transcript in which these orders were located. But of course, a person suspicious of the possibility that at least that some people in the police staff were not dealing squarely would have been, it seems to me, terribly upset by a radio log which is turned over to the commission as the radio log. Hensley didn't say this is an abridged copy, I assure you. Hensley said, this log has every statement connected with the assassination is in this log.
Well, and there's something else that I want to make mention that was in this WCAU interview program, and that is the fact that where Tippett was shot by Oswald was three blocks from the home of Jack Ruby. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out, if you're looking at a map and where individual A, individual B, individual C are located, you've got Oswald's rooming house in the Oak Cliff area. Three blocks away is where Jack Ruby lives. You got J.D. Tippett out of his area, basically disregarding orders to go to the school book depository. There were no standing orders for Tippett to move into Oak Cliff to confront Oswald, unless he was ordered to confront Oswald with the purpose of killing Oswald because J.D. Tippit was part of the conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. We know there was a relationship between Dallas and the Cable Brothers, Dallas Police, the mayor, the CIA, deputy director. I mean, these relationships are well known. What President Kennedy was walking into that day, November 22nd, 1963, was a well-coordinated coup d'etat against the president. And even if somebody was onto this, I don't think if 20 people knew about it and started to come clean, I think that everything was in motion. Nothing could have stopped this. This thing was too well-planned and had connections to the highest levels of the government, including the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, the vice president of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson, people in the Pentagon, people in the CIA, people in the Dallas government and Dallas Police Department. You go on and on right down the line, and you see all the suspects that were involved in this assassination. One other thing. I talked about what happened to Tippit's car. It was put back into service that very same day, November 22nd. A few years later, it scrapped in a junkyard. What happened to the bronze casket that was used to carry President Kennedy's body from Dallas back to Washington? Well, this is what we know from the Associated Press. In early 1965, the casket was dropped from a military plane into an area where unstable and outdated weapons and ammunition are dumped. Kermit Hall, a member of the now-defunct Assassinations Records Review Board, told the Associated Press. The documents that were released show that the casket was dropped off the Maryland-Delaware border in 9,000 feet of water, Hall said Friday night. There's actually a map in the documents that pinpoints the coordinates where it was dropped. This is amazing. This is the casket that brought the president's body from Parkland Hospital in Dallas to Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington. It is taken and dumped in the ocean. Why? The question is why. Tippit's car, Kennedy's casket. You can see the cover-up. The cover-up, one of the main elements of any cover-up is to destroy the evidence, and we know how much evidence in the assassination, the murder of President Kennedy, was destroyed. This is just more indications of the insidiousness of not just the people involved in the coup against Kennedy, but the members of the Warren Commission that actively participated in this cover-up. And what you heard from the WCAU segment was two authors back in 1965 were not buying it, and wrote books about it, and came, did an excellent job in poking holes, even with their very limited information at the time, in what was in the Warren Commission report. It was a whitewash. It was an unbelievable time in our country's history. And I always say that what happened to the United States, the reason we have fascism rampant today in this country, is it began on November 22nd, 1963, and it culminated on September 11, 2001. Everything in between, Watergate, the October surprise to get Jimmy Carter out of office with the Iran hostages, Iran-Contra, you name it, all the scandals in between were just part of the lead-up to what happened on 9-11. President Kennedy assassinated a pro-warmongering fascist, Lyndon Johnson comes in, replaced by the corrupt Richard Nixon, replaced by the go-along, get-along Warren Commission member Gerald Ford, interrupted by Jimmy Carter. They made fast work of him, of course, replaced by the idiot actor, the right-wing right-winger Ronald Reagan, replaced by George H.W. Bush, who was present at Dealey Plaza as a CIA agent on November 22nd, 1963, replaced by the go-along, get-along, do-anything-that-CIA-wants-me-to-do Bill Clinton, including running drugs through Arkansas, to fund Iran, the Iran-Contra operations, and then he's replaced by George W. Bush. The culmination of all this, 9/11 happened on his watch, and now we have another go-along, get-along in Barack Obama, former employee of Business International Corporation, a CIA front, and God knows what he was doing while he was supposedly partridge hunting in Pakistan when he was traveling there on his Indonesian passport in the name of Barry Satoru. We've only had two presidents who were worth anything. John F. Kennedy, this is after Eisenhower. Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex. John F. Kennedy came in, tried to do something about it, was murdered. We had Jimmy Carter, who tried to do something about it, was run out of office, and has been pretty well denigrated ever since. That's the situation in the United States today. We see it from history. We see it with the cover-ups, the constant cover-ups. These commissions are meaningless. This past week, I had the opportunity to chat with former Georgia Senator Max Cleland, who left three limbs in Vietnam. He was a member of the 9/11 Commission. He said we need new commissions. He didn't buy the 9/11 Commission. He left the commission to take a job with the Export-Import Bank. He never bought it. The story, and certainly many people, never bought the Warren Commission report. The Warren Commission report, the Warren report itself, is a joke. It's considered a joke. It's not the end. Certainly, it doesn't explain anything about what happened to President Kennedy, just like the 9/11 Commission report says nothing about what happened on that particular day in the skies over Washington, D.C., New York City, and Pennsylvania. Anyway, we have a short time left. We could try to get some phone calls in if you'd like to call into the program. The toll-free number is 800-313-9443. That's 800-311. I'm sorry. That's 800-313-9443. Toll-free. We might be able to get your calls in before the end of the program, but this was definitely a nice find to get this. When radio really put things out there, this was a commercial station, certainly not an NPR station, but back in those days, people who had public broadcast licenses put out real information and not the claptrap you hear today from the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly and all these other blabbermouths and the phony corrupt preachers and the incessant nonsense you hear on sports radio. I don't know what kind of mind it takes to listen to that idiocy, that people would call in, listen to sports talk radio, and actually call in worried about what some quarterback is going to do, or whether some idiot who doesn't even speak English is traded from one baseball team to another. I mean, it's beyond me, but that's where the public airwaves have gone, at least back in 1965. The folks that were at WCAU in Philadelphia realized that the Kennedy assassination left so many questions. It was important to get the real word out. Let's go to Clarence, our friend from Oklahoma, who's calling in. Clarence, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Wayne. It's good to speak with you again.
Well, it's good to speak with you, even though I don't have much of a voice left after swine flu, but go ahead.
I can hear the scratchiness there.
Yes, it was not easy.
This is very interesting. I really enjoyed this presentation tonight because I'm of the age that I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing.
Right.
It was about 12:30 Central Standard Time. And since I'm in Oklahoma, I was just 200 north of where these events were taking place. And I was out of school that day. I was in the seventh grade, I believe. But I had to talk about the flu. I had the flu. The regular flu back then. So I was watching television, and the local TV station, I guess the network was dark back then between noon and 1 o'clock Central Time.
Right.
And they put their own little shows on, weather, news, sports, talk, whatever.
Sure.
And I'll never forget the they had a the afternoon talk show, and Ferranti and Teicher used to have a lot of piano movie theme hits, were being interviewed by a local personality who's long gone, Tom Paxton. And it was just after 12:30 that the news director, Ernie Schulz, they didn't at that time, I don't know if they had the ability to switch from one set to the other with a camera, because Ernie had done the noon news earlier. He walked right onto the set at about 12:35. And Tom Paxton was surprised. He said, "Matt, can I help you?" And he said, "Well, we just got a flash from the Associated Press that shots were fired at the president's motorcade just minutes ago in Dallas, Texas." He said, "No more information. We'll get it to you as we can." And it was so interesting because I remember I read the book, Death of a President, by William Manchester. And I don't know how much of that, but they said that at the time, the press bus was somewhat, it was farther behind than normal than in the queue of cars there. And that they only had, there was no cell phones. Can you imagine how, the young people, they can't imagine how, what would you call it, primitive the communications were at that time. They had an old-fashioned radio telephone in that press bus. And there was only one, and it was in the front by the driver. And I'll never forget, Merriman Smith, I believe, with UPI, and Jack Bell of the AP, and I could have those reversed, but one or the other, they were both.
Oh, hold on, Clarence.
Yeah, and I'll finish this right quick.
We got a break. We'll come right back to you right after this short break. This is Wayne Matson coming from Washington, D.C.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Okay, welcome back. This is Wayne Matson with the Wayne Matson Report from Washington, D.C., and we're talking to Clarence. And Clarence, why don't you complete your thought that you had, you're reminiscing about Dallas before we had to go to the break.
The two guys actually fought each other over that phone. I mean, went to fisticuffs. And I've been down to the sixth floor museum, they call it, down there in Dallas.
Right.
Sister
right.
took me in 91 for my birthday, 40th. And anyway, I went up there. I saw it. They saved the old UPI copy. It's there, you know, with the flash is 10 bells, you know, and a bulletin is 5 bells. And I want to say this, and in closing, I'm going to get into a lot of put on, but I was impressed by that visit that day. It was newly opened, the museum was. I went up. You can't stand in the actual window, but I could.
Yep.
The window next to it, I stood in, looked out. And you can't get a good, you can watch all the documentaries you want. You don't, anyone who's interested out there, I would encourage them, if you get a chance, go see that museum. Walk Dealey Plaza. I did. It gives you a sense of perspective and where things are.
Right.
You don't get on television. But I'll say this right quick. I looked out that window, and I was in the Air Force as a security policeman, and I had to qualify with the M16 and 38 caliber pistol yearly.
Right.
And I know I'm not a firearms expert, but I know enough of how to shoot a weapon. And as I stood in that next to that window, you know where they make the turn from? Was it? Well, they were coming down Houston and then turned on to. I get those streets mixed up. It was before they made the turn toward the book depository, before the hairpin turn, they call it. I looked there, and at that point, traffic was coming straight at me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I ask you, why did Oswald wait until he made the hairpin turn, if it was Oswald that made the shot, and wait and fire through a tree with leaves on it?
Yes.
And there's an exit marks the spot on the street if you go down there where the car supposedly was when the shots were fired. Anyone, and I know this, and I'm not an expert, just out of my own, common sense, because anyone who knows anything about shooting a rifle at distance, I could have shot anyone coming at me straight forward. They're like they're almost like a standing target or a non-moving target when they're coming straight towards you. And
right.
I could have done it with an open sight M16, much less a
right.
scope. So I'll let it go with that, and maybe you might be able to get some more also.
Okay. Okay. Well, thanks, Clarence, for calling in. And let's go to quickly to Deborah, who's been waiting in on the phone from Maryland. And Deborah, you'll take us to the end of the program here. We have a few minutes left.
Welcome back, Wayne. You were so missed.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. You know, I love your show, and I love that you're covering the Kennedy assassination. It's really interesting. That day we were sent home from school, I must have been 7 or 8 at the time, my mother saying they killed Kennedy.
Right, right. And I recall that Governor Connolly told me in Texas one time when I met him, he said, I asked him, why did you say they're going to kill us all? He said, because we were being shot at from different directions. Funny
yeah.
that never made it in the Warren Report.
Oh,
when,
a lot of things never made it into the
exactly. And Jackie said, "My God, they killed Jack." They used the plural. Two people in the car said they, you know, and we're supposed to think that Oswald was the lone gunman, just like all these other lone gunmen.
And brilliant that you connected 9/11 to it all.
Right, absolutely. It's the other end of the bookshelf, as far as I'm concerned. But thanks, Deborah, for calling in, and that'll do it for this week with the Wayne Matz Report. And we will hopefully be back with you with a better voice, hopefully this time next week, coming to you from Washington D.C. This is Wayne Matz, and we'll see you on the radio next week.